Okay, all right.
Okay, it is July 18th, 2017. I am doing part two of my oral history with Dean Spade. We're doing the conversation remotely over the phone, and I just wanted to follow up because Dean has been active in various movements in the past few decades and has a lot of insight into the history and direction of trans politics to just get some of those insights added to this oral history. So, Dean, can you tell me what is, I think, the toughest, or you think the toughest thing for activists to learn when they become a part of a movement? What is something that you think is challenging to learn, I guess?
That's a good question. What's challenging to learn when you become part of a movement? I mean, I think this really depends on people and where they're coming from, in their life experience, right? So for some people, when they enter a movement, like one of the hardest things is like rigor, like being in groups for long meetings and having to make decisions together or having to follow up from the tasks they've been assigned or do like be be where they said they were going to be or be on time for others or like do a task that's like kind of boring, like driving someone around or helping people fill out forms or you know what I mean? Like that's like I think one for some people like the kind of like working in the movement is more challenging and they're in it more for like the thrills of the like amazing march or like the protest or the disruption, So I think for some people that's challenging. Whereas for others, I think people like struggle. I think people who struggle with like publicly taking a stand, like having to be the person who like is part of yelling at the mayor while they're on stage and disrupting the event and feeling like, oh my God, that's so scary and like the kind of risk taking of taking a strong position and being out on a limb publicly, like is really hard for some people depending off on like, how they adapted to their lives growing up and like what kind of pressures were on them. I think like for some of us, like entering movements, a lot of times I think people enter movements because they're pissed about oppression they've experienced, and so they come in from that perspective. And it can be complicated to come into a really mixed space with lots of different kinds of people and realize that they also have privilege. So like, I'm not only the oppressed in this situation; I'm also somebody who needs to like step back and let others participate, or who needs to like focus on fostering other people's leadership, or like get more skills that are about like also being critical of how I'm like participating here from the perspective of that I have privilege. So I think that like that can be if people are entering because they're pissed at what happened to them, that part can be like newer or harder or like an expectation they weren't didn't have skills at yet or wanted to but didn't, it can be like kind of like a period of trying to figure out like what does that feel like and what and how would that play out. I think also like for a lot of people in movement, like just trusting other people is really hard. Like if you've been kind of going it alone and like been in a lot of hostile environments where there wasn't a lot of other people like you, and I've seen this a lot in trans movements, like a lot, especially when I first started doing a lot of trans stuff in the early 2000s, like so many places I would go and talk to trans people or even different trans people in New York, if they'd been just like roughing it out by themselves and doing a ton of like work by themselves, like they had to train the place that they worked, or they'd been keeping being asked to train a place where they're the only trans person in the room, or they're the only trans client of this service agency, and they're having to do all the advocacy, so they get kind of like really used to doing it alone, and it can actually be hard to then start doing it collaboratively, or to like make decisions in a group because they've had both like the unfortunate aspects of doing it alone, but also like they get to control the narrative, or they get to like get all the attention, or depending on their personality, that may like be a difficult transition. I've seen that a lot because of the ways that trans people are put into, have often been isolated. Like that isolation can make the transition to working with others difficult. And for some people, I think as that movement has grown, depending on like where they were living or what part of the, what sector they were working in or whatever, that transition may have occurred during their, activist lifetime, and it could have felt like really competitive with other people who came into the scene, or just struggled to have a good collaborative relationship. I mean, I think people really vary. I mean, another thing that comes up that can be really hard is like overwork, like taking on too much, wanting to please everybody, wanting, feeling everything is urgent and indispensable, and then like just becoming totally overcommitted and you know, not being able to follow through or having like a health crisis. Like, that's a really common pattern for people because there's so much urgency and so much need and so much needs to be done. And like, we don't necessarily have skills for knowing like how to measure what's a realistic amount to take on, or maybe we're motivated to take things on because we want to feel indispensable, or we want to feel really able to like us. And so then there's like having like this outrageous workload. I mean, I think there's just so much of what happens to people in movements relates to like our broader existing emotional patterns and like what kinds of ways we come in resourced and what kind of ways we come in like, you know, having been unsupported in our lives in different ways and like missing certain skills, whether it's the skill to see our own privilege or whether it's like the skill to collaborate with others or whether like we weren't in spaces where we could trust people, so it's hard to trust people now. I think a lot of times in movements you see a lot of conflict because people are having to, you know, everyone's showing up with their own histories and difficulties and wounds and sensitive spots, and they're rubbing each other the wrong way. And you also see, I think, sometimes a lot of people getting to become more full people through those relationships and like through the feedback we get. Like, that's definitely my experience. Like, I got to learn a lot about myself by making mistakes in movement organizations and by getting feedback from other people in movement organizations about things I was doing that weren't working or things that I was doing that were a good contribution. So that, like, I feel like in the same way other important relationships can help us kind of grow us up or like help us become more whole or like fill out parts of ourselves that were underdeveloped by the conditions we were in or that we were afraid to develop. I think participating in movements can have that affect people at its best.
Thanks. That was a very thorough answer. I wanted to circle back a little bit when you brought up this issue of urgency. We're living right now under the Trump administration, and after Trump was endowed the presidency, I still don't want to say elected, there was sort of a split among progressives on what that meant, or people who consider themselves to be progressive. And some people said, you know, this is unprecedented, this is extraordinary. This represents an aberration in the country's history, et cetera, et cetera. And then there were others that said, no, what he represents has been going on for, you know, decades and this sort of thing. And for people who have been doing work for so many years on so many different issues and have such sharp critiques, what is your take on the time that we're in, and how do you respond to those sorts of perceptions? How do they differ from your own perception of the time that we're in now, living under this administration?
Yeah, I also saw those reactions, and I think that it's an interesting dialogue that says a lot about, you know, different kinds of access to analysis and information that different populations have. So I feel like it makes a lot of sense for a lot of people to be kind of like newly shocked and offended to have like, you know, a president who's a rapist and a climate change denier and openly racist and all of those things. You know, that should be alarming. But I really get, and I could see how that could bring some people to a new feeling of urgency that they hadn't had before. And then for those of us who were already part of social movements that felt that things were urgent and desperate, it makes sense that we would have also a critique of like, yeah, like this is of a piece. Like this presidency has a lot to do with all the prior presidencies and like with the things that this country's institutions were like founded to do around, you know, racism, slavery, settler colonialism, you know, immigration enforcement, et cetera. I think for me, what it really feels like is the Trump presidency is all the other recent presidencies, but like with a lot of aspects of the mask pulled off or something. So like the mask of multiculturalism has been a strategy, especially of the Democratic Party, but also to some degrees of the Republican Party in recent decades. So like pretending to like have some talking points about racism, meanwhile like maintaining like, you know, extremely deadly actual policies and practices towards people of color. And like the Trump administration doesn't really bother with the mask of multiculturalism or the mask of like kind of neoliberal faux feminism or like other kind of what I would call maybe like fake progressive masks. You know, so that's interesting in terms of like the level of the symbolic and representative. And then I think in terms of policy, it is like an intensification of the existing. So it's like Obama like built up this outrageously massive immigration enforcement regime, and that, and he, you know, many people and movements tried to get him to not build it up and to like reduce it or dismantle parts of it before Trump came into office, and he didn't choose to do that, and so then Trump gets to use that, and so like that's not, it would be a mistake to be to pretend that Trump invented that or that that wasn't a collaboration between all the prior regimes that has made that, you know, this size. On the other hand, the level of the symbolic matters, because I think like even before Trump had the chance to like change laws, his the election or the, you know, the presidency of like an openly white supremacist, openly anti-immigrant, person has really emboldened like police and ICE and other immigration enforcement agencies. There's a sense in which even before he changes the law, people are already saying like immigration judges are doing different things. There's a sense of emboldened in the tactics of all of those agents of the state who have so much discretion to do their jobs in ways that are way even more like brutal, punishing, and murderous. So it matters a lot that we have this administration in place, and it can do a lot of extreme harm. And the mistake would be to like think that we'd be better off. You know, and things would be great if we had a Democrat, right? Like, that's the mistake, and that actually allows the Democratic Party to keep moving to the right further when we kind of let them be the alternative in our minds, or when we think. So I think that one of the ways that like right wing regimes keep moving things to the right for everybody, not just for them, but also for like the supposed left, and just like whole picture moves right, which it's been doing, you know, solidly in the United States for, you know, many, many presidencies. The way it keeps moving right is that, like, it represents the new, like, low bar, and then anybody who's, like, slightly above that bar gets credited as being progressive, even though they're actually really far to the right. So that's what I'm, like, worried about as well, like, whether or not we have another Trump administration after this or another horrible Republican administration that's similar. I feel like we'll still have a Democratic administration if we have one that's, like, to the right even of Obama, because that's, like, the whole negotiation keeps inching in that direction, and since all those parties are like for the benefit of white rich settlers, like that's in all of their interest to go that way, and then the politics of the symbolic is moving in that direction, and the bar is very low for them to look progressive, because they just have to be like, yes, climate change exists, or yes, Paris Accords, or, you know, yes, rape is wrong, and then like they suddenly look progressive, you know, whether or not any of their politics actually supports like the wellness of people or the planet. So I think it's a complicated thing in that moment. I think I've also felt like things feel very end timesy, you know. I know that everybody says that people always feel that they're at the end of time, but like something about having this like total clown, like this person who's, I like literally keep feeling like I'm inside a parody, you know, especially when his tweets are read out loud on TV or like, you know, on Democracy Now! Headlines that I listen to. I'm just like, did that really happen? There's the parody aspect of it feels like this last gasping of like U.S. empire that's just so like absurd and like openly like destructive and murderous. But I also remember that during the George W. Bush presidency, like his stupidity was really celebrated, and I think actually it was to the benefit of his administration to pretend that he was stupid. So the like incredible amount of traction they gained for really horrible, nightmarish things to happen, and the amazing like amount of change they actually made to the U.S. government and military in their short, you know, time, like, was kind of under the mask of this like, story about how stupid he is. So I think it's, like, one of the things I worry about right now is, like, the danger of a focus on Donald Trump as a person, because it just, like, that's the whole thing, right? He's a brand, he's a celebrity, like, it doesn't really matter. He doesn't really matter. What matters is, like, the institution of the presidency and the administration and then, like, all the broader law enforcement agencies and, like, the broader conditions, and I think he's sort of a distraction in that way. At times, because we can just kind of talk about him and his hijinks rather than having people have a deeper analysis of the conditions they live under that they would be living under even if they had, you know, Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama as president. So yeah, I mean, it's a wild time that feels really, really scary, and I think that debate about whether things are so much worse or not is a debate that really just tells us more about the what people in the U.S. do and don't know about the country they live in and the conditions they live under, and like what constitutes enough to seem scary or problematic, and what constitutes enough amelioration of that to go back to sleep or not be active. And then the other question is, like, a lot of people got pissed and motivated by this election, but what did they do? Like, were they just encouraged to, like, give the Planned Parenthood online or the ACLU? Like, did they do anything else in their communities that, like, let them become political participants or expanded their political viewpoints or build new relationships or actually, like, support people who are in the worst conditions? Like, or were there kind of containment strategies that made their action, like, kind of minimal or symbolic? And like, what's kind of what's really happening with what people's political imaginations are about how they can participate at this point? Like, that's a big question for me, and like also the role of like social media and like help people feel like they've done something when they've just like said something to a limited set of viewers on social media. And so like, how are some of the, where, I'm curious, what are some of the current containment strategies that make you feel like you've done something when you have not actually gotten any of the benefits of political participation that can come, like more relationships, new analysis, increased safety and preparedness for the next disaster because you know where people in your neighborhood or like anything like that. So I think that's like another kind of dilemma that we're seeing at this point.
Now, you just discussed how the right has pushed Americans, I guess, as a whole, but also politicians further and further to the right. So our understanding of what's a progressive, or even when people use the word leftist, is radically different from what those terms might signify in other contexts or countries. And I'm wondering, how has this push to the, what you perceive as being a push to the right, affected politics shaping and impacting the lives of trans and gender nonconforming people?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few ways. So, like, one thing is that the entire story of what we would now maybe commonly get to call the LGBT movement is one of these stories of, like, this shift from, like, what I would understand as a more left politics that was in the mix the 1960s and 70s, when there was, like, you know, international anti-colonial movements happening. There was, like, kind of an internationalist framework in the United States of a fight against white supremacy and colonialism, and there was a feminist and queer politics that was, like, you know, very much a part of that, intermixed with that, and lots of different overlapping movements, and that politics was pretty explicitly, like, anti-war, anti-police, and then, you know, as the crackdown came against that politics and what we call, like, neoliberalism emerges, we see the rise of, and we see this in lots of movements, we see, like, the rise of a different strain of that movement. This happened not only in the LGBT movement, but elsewhere, where there's a rise of a strain that divorces itself from the left content of the politics and instead proposes an inclusion politics that just is really about, like, include lesbian and gay people in the military, include lesbian and gay people in marriage, include lesbian and gay people in the police forces, like a kind of a new framework that abandoned and kind of that basically proposed what I would consider like a conservative gay inclusion politics, which then had often a, you know, complex battle about whether or not trans people should be included in that, because that politics was pretty assimilationist and wanted to make gay people look like the kinds of good citizens who deserve to be included, and so trans people, like, and also lots of other people made that look bad, and so then there was kind of this battle to, like, have a trans politics like that. So there's been this, like, that's been going on. Meanwhile, of course, there's also been the whole time, like, an ongoing very left queer and trans feminist politics that has been doing work against policing and doing work against war, and has, like, continuously articulated a critique of the rise of that very visible, you know, kind of pro-existing systems, inclusion-focused politics. So that, like, sort of divide and the, like, ongoing mainstreaming of trans politics that we see now, increasingly seeing, like, you know, mainstream culture has just, like, discovered trans advocacy and trans people, and there's trans people on every TV show. And what that new discovery is, you know, is like, the emergence of that more narrow, assimilationist, inclusion-focused framework for trans people. Like, that, and so, like, now the LGBT organizations, like, are doing that for trans people. Like, there's a kind of, like, a, there's now, like, a legitimate way to be trans, which, of course, always implies that there's also an illegitimate way, so there's basically the rise of, like, an image of, like, professional, usually white, you know, upper class, you know, presumed not disabled set of trans people who are deserving citizens and who should be able to, you know, be in the military and should be able to be police and should be able to be corporate leaders and politicians and lawyers and whatever. That whole story is, like, this moment of mainstreaming, which brings, like, trans people's humanness into, like, public debate in some new way, but only in the under these conditions in which humanness is still tied to, like, whiteness, able-bodiedness, you know, not being a person with a conviction, not being a person with, who's undocumented, etc. So we still have, we, you know, now this divide between, and it's, you know, it's more complicated than I, than the account I'm giving, because there's so much complexity about, you know, in every part of this about the way different issues cut and the way different moments of advocacy and these things are debated. But ultimately what's happening is kind of like the rise of an acceptable trans figure and advocacy around that that is similar to the advocacy that happened for lesbian and gay people as that sort of movement had grew a neoliberal or conservative wing. And that advocacy affirms existing conditions and institutions through the story of accepting, like, a hated population into it. And one part of the way we talk about that is through the term pinkwashing. So the idea that, like, and this, I think this is actually really important right now, like, one way that institutions and systems that are being targeted as racist and harmful and colonial can, like, try to, like, do PR for themselves right now is to say that they are pro-gay or trans. Like, it's a way to appear progressive and detract attention from, like, what it is they're actually doing that they're under critique for. So, like, that term, as you know, was popularized and is most commonly used when talking about the explicit strategies of the state of Israel to do a PR campaign to make itself look, like, modern and innovative and diverse and all of these things in the face of, you know, global opposition to its apartheid regime and colonization of Palestine and genocide against the Palestinian people. So Israel has, like, this really huge marketing campaign about how gay-friendly it is and how gay people can serve in the military and all of this stuff. And that is not done alone by Israel. That strategy was used by the Obama campaign in the second term to sort of make Obama the quote-unquote gay president and, like, distract from his, like, extreme, you know, politics of deportation and, you know, war and whistleblowers and all millions of things by making him seem progressive because he's, like, attached to this, like, you know, front lines issue of, you know, gay marriage, and then eventually even some stuff around trans things, and, you know, corporations use it, and lots of local politicians use it. Like, we see it all the time, you know, locally here in Seattle, where our local politicians, you know, they want to distance themselves from the reality that they, like, you know, that the Seattle Police Department, you know, is, you know, kills black people, and they want to distance themselves from, you know, the new jail project they're building. So then they, like, have a press conference about how they're declaring Washington a hate-free state. You know, like, they use the idea that they're progressive because they like gay, lesbian people or LGBT people as a way to really make themselves look different than what their politics are, including the actual politics of what the things that affect queer trans people. I mean, that's what's so wild about it, is, like, queer trans people don't really benefit when institutions or politicians or states declare themselves LGBT-friendly, because they're still doing all the stuff that hurts queer trans people, even if that stuff is not in the name of queer trans people. Maybe it's just that they're deporting people, but there's lots of reasons queer trans people are more likely to be deported, or maybe they're just putting people in prison, but there's lots of reasons why those people are more likely to be imprisoned. And so this whole dynamic is very, I think, very complex, and it's extremely live right now. Like, it's really one of the favorite strategies of institutions and politicians to make themselves look progressive and hide what they're actually doing. And so that's really complicated, I think, for trans people right now, because, like, supposedly we're having our moment in the sun, but the actual conditions that make that possible and the actual, like, likelihood that will result in good things for us are pretty troubling.
Now, you received the Kessler Award in 2016, and you gave a speech in which you said that it was about 2 months, I think, after Trump entered office, and you said, this is a time for nobodies. And what you just said in that answer made me think a little bit about that. Could you talk a little bit about what you meant maybe your thinking around what you know, this is a time for nobody's means has evolved, but if you could just speak to that a little bit and what you see as being effective and, I guess, community and life-affirming political practice in this moment.
Yeah. So I was quoting Raina Gossett, who gave a talk the year before, a graduation speech at Hampshire College, where she talked about the idea of nobody's. And I thought it was so helpful. I mean, one part of it is the way in which the hierarchies occur in our society, the way they work is that they want us all to, like, desire to be somebody and be willing to ignore anybody who we've been told is a nobody. You know, like, the fact that some people are disposable is essential to, like, capitalism and white supremacy, to having a prison state, to having a police state, to having, you know, border enforcement. Like, we have to believe that these people don't matter, that some people are not important, they're not worthy, they're not really human, and we have to all be striving to not be nobody, but to be somebody. And this also is really important inside our movements, because one of the ways that our movements get so co-opted by, you know, major institutions and governments is by, you know, buying us, like, having us sell out, like, to use a kind of old-fashioned term, right, to have it be like, wow, like, I could get a job at this place if I go and kind of, like, represent LGBT for them, or tell them that what they're doing is okay, or help them sell a really watered-down version of our politics, or make their TV show seem really hip by having some, like, problematic trans content, or whatever. Like, there's a way in which we're all asked to participate in making our movements, like, watered down or ineffective by, like, you know, we're being bought, or by selling out of people in our movements, like, by accepting political compromises where we're like, well, this will help white, rich, trans people who have citizenship, and it'll actually hurt trans people who are not that, but let's go for it. You know, kind of like that kind of selling out as well, all those political compromises that are really typical of inclusion movements that kind of, you know, affirm institutions like the police or the military, or the system of capitalist employment or whatever, in the name of getting a few people included, whereas, like, the most vulnerable people don't get shit. So that's, like, part of why I thought that was important. But another piece of this is, like, the thing I felt really strongly when the election happened and so many new people were mobilized and pissed and scared, which was a really reasonable and appropriate reaction to the election, I felt really disturbed, as I mentioned before, that most people don't have meaningful ways to plug into political action, and I felt like a lot of organizations and institutions were doing irresponsible things by misleading people into thinking they'd take action from small things. So an example of this was that the ACLU created a pledge you could do online that said that you pledge to protect the Constitution, and, like, you go onto their website and you click and pledge to protect the Constitution, and probably they should you for a donation or whatever. And I just was like, what the fuck? Like, that does absolutely nothing. Like, absolutely nothing. Also, like, even the marketing that the ACLU was going to, like, sue Trump and that was going to save us all, like, you know, is so irresponsible. It's not true. You cannot, like, most of what's going on in the United States, telling people already, isn't something you can win a lawsuit about. Like, the border isn't illegal. Having the largest prison system in the world isn't illegal. Like, all the, like we can't sue our way out of this, you know? Like, there, yes, occasionally you can win a lawsuit about something, and sometimes you can get some relief, but often it's just symbolic. So the idea that, like, people's anger and fear would would be channeled into, like, this useless clicking something online, like, really worried me. And also it worried me because, I mean, obviously the HIV should do whatever it wants, but part of the reason that feels so irresponsible or scary is because most people have been deprived of real, meaningful information about what, how social movements work, how to get involved in them, like, what the histories of social change are, like, how change really happens. Most people have been raised in the United States on, like, really simplistic, untrue stories about how, like, one lawsuit, like Brown versus Board of Education, like, you know, ended racism, or, like, if you care about something, all you can do basically is, like, vote or, like, click on things online or, like, give somebody money. There's, like, very little access to information or, like, frameworks around, like, how to do meaningful social change work in your own community. And also, social change has been, like, framed as a career, so, like, unless it's not your job, unless it's your job, like, there's nothing you can do about it kind of thing. So that really worried me. So what I was focusing on in that speech, and what I did focus on a lot since then, is trying to help people spread ideas about mutual aid projects. So mutual aid is, like, one term for it. Some people use the term, like, self-help. There's a lot of different terms for it. Basically, when people get together to do work in their community to provide each other things that they vitally need, but the framework isn't, like, a charity framework, which is, like, you know, generally charity frameworks are where, like, you know, like, it's, you know, rich people, you know, give, like, crumbs to poor people, like, based on the idea that they, like, you know, to get into heaven or to get a tax break, often for the rich people, and always there's kind of, like, judgment included, like, oh, you can have money, you can have food, but you can't have money because we're worried you would spend it on drugs, and we don't think you could manage it, and you're not housing ready because you're not sober or because you don't take your meds, like, all this kind of, like, framing that makes it seem like people are poor because there's something wrong with them, or people are homeless because there's something wrong with them. Mutual aid is the opposite of that. It's like, there's something wrong with the society and with the structures, and that's why people don't have things they need. So let's give each other things they need, that we need, in a politicized context, and let's do it as part of our broader work to, like, transform and dismantle the current system and build a world in which everybody has everything they need. So people do all kinds of mutual aid projects all the time. Most of them are unpaid, like, non-professional projects people just commit to doing together. Like, you know, examples are, like, if we were to create a carpool so people can visit people and visit their families in prisons where the prison's kind of far away in our state. Or if we're going to do a food program, we're going to hand out free food at the park on Fridays. Or if we're going to do a child care collective so that we will make child care available for people so they can go to political meetings or, like, go to the doctor's appointment or whatever and not, like, you know, not have a way to take care of their kids and either face getting busted by CPS for leaving their kids alone or, you know, not be able to go to the thing they need to go to. Or, I mean, mutual aid programs can be anything. It can, like, you know, here in Seattle, we've had a long-term project that when, like, an employer doesn't pay somebody or a landlord doesn't give back money they owe a tenant, these people, like, go and they do protests at the lawyer, at the landlord's house or at the boss's house and, like, force them to give the money back by, like, making, like, a public spectacle, and they've, like, gotten tons of money for people back from these, you know, that the court system would never have been able to get back for these tenants and employees. Or, you know, mutual aid projects can be a zillion things. It can be, like, disaster relief, like Occupy Sandy. It's a zillion things, but basically to me, mutual aid is, like, what's really, one of the things that's really, really missing in the political imagination right now. Like, people have a hard time thinking about quote-unquote nobodies, right? People have a hard time thinking about who is actually not getting what they need right now. People love to think about the big symbolic issues in our kind of media field, and, like, we're a lot about, like, what's represented. We're not a lot about, like, kind of the daily mundane realities of how many people in our country are, like, broke, criminalized, like, deportable, you know, single parents, like, inadequately housed, all those things. And so, like, what would it take to have a lot of people who are really pissed right now, instead of only being funneled into, like, symbolic acts or, like, you know, raging on Facebook, actually, like, be part of, like, a committed project in their community to, like, meet some unmet need. And, like, by doing that, you have to meet a lot of other people, and you often learn a lot about, like, social structures that you weren't aware of, and maybe you go in pissed about a particular thing, but then you end up learning about, like, other aspects of it or other differences inside that community or other vulnerabilities or how that system really works. And, like, it's very politically meaningful, and you form relationships with people that we all often have to, like, build trust and help each other out and, like, do boring or weird or complicated things together, and that can be really, like, you know, incredible. And those people are people who are going to, like, help you out when you're sick later or, like, when you need childcare. Like, I mean, like, this is, like, I think it just, like, builds a depth of both political structure for our movement and analysis for us as people and relationships that can really help us with, like, the current and coming crises. I really believe in, like, mutual aid as this alternative, you know, or this, I mean, a long-standing existing thing, but it's an alternative framework to the one that I think we're mostly sold about what we should do right now, which is mostly, like, giving money to a few large organizations or social media, or maybe, like, get a career in social justice, which is, like, a totally different thing that, you know, like, only a few people can get paid to do these kinds of jobs in the big picture, right? Whereas the stuff, the analysis that needs to happen is huge. So after that Kessler lecture, one of the things I was working on for a long time was a website that is called bigdoorbrigade.com that, like, has a mutual aid toolkit that's about, like, what is mutual aid, and that has, like, a lot of mutual aid projects.
Big Door?
Big Door, yeah.
Okay.
Listed with, like, you know, details about how they do it, and just to, like, stuff to inspire people, and also tools that you could replicate to create these projects in your own community. Just because I think a lot of this stuff, like, can be, you know, somewhat hard to find depending on, like, how much of a beginner a person is at, like, thinking about this stuff. And I'm working now on a video with a filmmaker who makes kind of, like, interesting animated films to try to, like, popularize the idea of mutual aid a little bit more and share some of the stuff I just said to you. But yeah, I mean, it's just, I think part of it is, like, I really care about poor people, and I think poverty is, like not hip, like, it's not interest, like, that politic people are getting riled up about often, like, kind of lead out the piece around poverty, like, and, like, the day-to-day conditions that affect so many people. So it's, like, people, even people who are willing to go to a march about the police killed somebody, which is so important, then, like, in between aren't doing any of the things in their own communities that could help make the next person a little bit less vulnerable to policing, because a lot of the things that make you vulnerable to policing relate to being poor, like having, you know, mental health crises, but not knowing people to call besides the cops, or not having, like, support in your community, or, like, you know, not being adequately housed, or all of these things. And so I guess I'm part of it for me is, like, yeah, like, wanting us to move also from, like, this moment we're in right now where a lot of people, like, want to get famous on Twitter, or, like, including people with politics. There's still a desire to be somebody and a desire to ignore nobodies that I think throughout are the ways that we internalize capitalism and white supremacy and then practice our politics, even our radical politics. And that makes a lot of sense, and we should all have compassion for ourselves that we have those kinds of thoughts and, like, buy into that stuff. But I was hoping to kind of, like, share some stuff that would help people think some of that through. And, like, Raina's idea about nobodies, I think, is actually a really very succinct way of asking ourselves, are there people I think are nobody, and, like, am I trying to be somebody, and, like, how does that play out, and what would I do differently in my day-to-day political work if I didn't think anybody should be nobody, you know?
I remember earlier this year, I stumbled across an article about a woman whose name escapes me, who is an activist and headed the first union of welfare recipients. And I had no idea there was once a union for welfare recipients where they would push back against the way the government treated welfare recipients, the amount of money, the provisos that they would put in place to require, you know, welfare recipients to hold down certain kinds of jobs or not, you know, drink alcohol, and how the collapse of that union and her life's work led to what we saw in the 90s under Clinton, where, you know, you had welfare being tied to reproductive injustice sort of policies, which didn't begin with Clinton, but were exacerbated a lot by his welfare bill. And I thought that was interesting. I have to look up her name again. But I mean, the other, I guess my one pushback against what you're saying is that we're also living in a context where people don't have to sell out per se in the way that in our generation we think of selling out, like, you know, I've been part of these movements, or I cared about such and such issue, but I'm going to work for this evil corporation. Like, the idea of the evil corporation sort of died with social media. And people give so much of their labor, their creativity, their time to social media, and I think receive a kind of psychological wage from that. And definitely people who are digital natives, I think it can be more intense because you didn't live in a time where there was no internet, you know. And so there's like this surveillance piece, there's this piece about psychological dues, and there isn't really the same analysis of power regarding corporate entities, military entities, etc., that I feel was more available and more accessible to our generation. I don't know if you agree with that, but I feel like that's a huge elephant in the room when I think about trying to do anything that helps people that have fewer resources and trying to galvanize people to do things about it. Because right now we have GoFundMe, we have Kickstarter, we have these sorts of platforms which have sort of become this tiny band-aid on this like ocean of need that has been created by the decline of different kinds of services, entitlements, benefits, access to care, etc. And I don't know. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that, or maybe you have thoughts about that or not. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I really agree with what you're saying. I think, like, I mean, I think it's hard to even have a full account of the impacts of all the things that the internet and social media, all the changes they are making for us politically, because we're so in the midst of it in many ways, like, kind of at the beginning of it still. Like, we're still a transition between those of us who grew up without it and then a very new, smaller set of people that's growing. But, like, it's still, like, just the beginning of anybody being a digital native, you know? And so it's interesting to think about this. I mean, and I wonder, I'm sure that my perspective on this is skewed. I just assume I'm missing a lot of things, and I really struggle to not be too anti-technology because of the ways in which I feel really astounded by some of the changes. Like, one of the things I am really worried about is the ways in which people are turned towards primarily maintaining a personal brand. And I think that social affirmation is a very deep human need, and so finding a way to kind of commodify that in likes and views online and make every single person believe they can kind of like feel fame, I think that has like a very addictive nature for people. Like, it's so many people tell me that like when they post something online, they like check constantly to see whether or not it's been seen or liked, and that it can become a very compulsive relationship to feel seen enough and liked enough. And yet, from what I understand, the research shows people have less in-person relationships than ever before, and more people live alone than ever before, and more and more people spend more and more of their time engaging only through screens and not with other live humans. And so, even though I think there's also like creative and interesting, wonderful, and connected things that happen, and of course, we see this in, you know, highly marginalized communities like trans communities and disability communities, where people have gotten to connect and build community online, often who are very isolated from others like them. I think there's a lot of wonderful things in that. I think I just am also very concerned about like kind of what it means to have a compulsive relationship to being seen in this way. And some of the things I see in social movements are stuff like I've seen people have really destructive relationships to social movement organizations, because I think when I was coming up, becoming part of an org that was radical and that had people like you in it and that represented your politics was like a really big deal, and you really wanted to like be part of that and contribute and be seen as part of that. But now I think it's really rewarding to go into an org like that and tear it down and show how much more radical you are than that on the internet, and that gets really rewarded, and you could like get a speaking tour out of that, or like feel kind of gay famous like elsewhere and more broadly internationally. And all that's happened is that people have liked, like, it doesn't, like, what's happening from what you did isn't causing the work the org used to do to get done now everywhere. It's just making a lot of people feel radical, and definitely I'm sure like good analysis was traded. But the dilemma is like the kind of tear down culture where we tear down other activists and tear down org so that we can promote ourselves as the most radical on social media and appear the most right, you know, just really is, like, not likely to build relationships, which is, like, the basis of social movement transformation. Like, it's not likely to cause, like, people to try hard things together and then, like, get feedback and grow and change and, like, stay in it and keep working in a particular, you know, region or local community or population. Like, it often undermines that kind of commitment, and there's kind of a lack of humility. It's like everyone's trying to be gay famous about it, and really the work of social movements includes, like, tons of, like, mundane support for one another, and, like, get, you know, somebody's got to sweep, and somebody's got to give a ride to people who can't drive, and somebody's got to make sure that, like, we send all the letters to people in prison so that they can give feedback on what we're thinking about doing before we develop the idea the next day. Like, us, just, like, it's a lot of, like, human care and connection, and that's not, I think that stuff is not, like, the attention span for that is weakening, and the, like, attraction of being glamorous online with your radical politics is pretty compelling, which, you know, and I say all of that while also being somebody who fully believes that we should critique, you know, critique each other and have feedback in our movements and our organizations. It's not about, like, falling into line or shutting up, but I think for me, historically, there's been a difference between, like, having maybe a public critique of, like, major institutions that are, like, you know, promoting evil ideas, but then having a really principled, sincere engagement with other people trying to do, like, really radical and transformative, like, anti-racist, feminist, queer work, by not, like, putting it, like, not, like, trying to expose them when I have a disagreement, but first, like, checking in and seeing whether we can, like, influence each other and, like, have a dialogue and, like, see who's at the table and, like, really try to figure out if we can go a different direction if I'm really concerned. Or often just, like, assuming they've already thought through it, maybe I don't know the most. You know what I mean? Like, that's also okay. But I feel like there's kind of a different incentive now, which is to, like, be the person who tears down the most radical thing first and most thoroughly, because that will make you look, that will give you the most, like, credit or something. And that is just really problematic and harmful, because I don't think that our social movement organizations that are so embattled and often tiny and overworked and dealing with all the crisis that comes from these systems, like, they usually just don't have the resources to handle it. Like, it can really cause a lot of harm because they're just very vulnerable. They don't have good communication strategies. That, yeah, so, like, people are really overworked and tired, and have a lot of people have identities where they've been under attack their whole life, so it's, like, really hurtful and painful. And so it's, I think the destruction from that is, like, a concern. And then more broadly, I'm concerned about just, like, the level of isolation people are experiencing. Like, when I think about, like, you know, Hurricane Katrina, which, like, was such an instructive, intense experience for so many communities in the United States to see, you know, that level of government abandonment, that level of environmental destruction, and the loss that has, that, you know, that New Orleans has in no way recovered from. One of the lessons people who were there talked a lot about, is that what if anything saved people was other people knowing where they were or knowing each other, having networks in place, like having connections. And I also heard this about Hurricane Sandy, like it was organizations like CAV that like knew that there were like elders living in Chinatown at the tops of buildings that didn't, where they wouldn't be able to get on the stairs and they wouldn't have water up there. Like, it's those relationships that actually relate to people's lives being sustainable or not in the face of all the crises, the coming ones and the ones we're already in. And so more and more people not having trusting or even at all any like kind of like live relationships with people in their immediate region or in their town or neighborhood, I think is actually just really dangerous for us. And then also getting our sense of the world through these corporations like you're describing, like through Facebook, through Twitter, through Tumblr, like having those corporations mediate our sense of like connectedness, relationship, the knowledge we're allowed to access, like that's just some scary shit. And I agree with you that I think there's just like very little critique or concern about that. Like those things sell themselves as liberating us and connecting us, and people act like that's what they're mainly there to do, but that's never what, you know, capitalism is there to do. So that feels really scary.
Is there anything you would like to add to this, or any, I know we have to wrap up in a few minutes, but any additional comment or thought you want to add?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, I think that was a good sort of overview of like the moment we're living in. And so I think maybe let's end it there. And yeah, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk with you again. And yeah, thank you. I'm excited that we have your story as a contribution to the Trans Oral History Archive. All right.
Thank you so much for including me and for taking the time to do this work, Nadia. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Dean.